The night wore on, but both of them were too strung up to think of sleeping. And when he refused a third whiskey, she went through to the kitchen to make a pot of coffee, and he followed her. He stood behind her with his arms around her waist while they waited for the water to come to the boil. "General Smuts has given me the Interior Ministry in the new cabinet," Blaine said. "One of the reasons he chose me was that I have already chaired the Commission of Inquiry into the Oseva Brandvag and the other subversive organizations. It will be one of my major concerns to suppress their efforts to disrupt our preparations for war. The Ubas himself has taken the Ministry of Defence, and he has already promised Britain an army of 50,000 volunteers, ready to fight anywhere in Africa." They took the coffee tray through to the sitting room, and as Santaine poured, the telephone rang, shrill and shocking in the silent cottage. She started and spilled steaming coffee over the tray.
"What time is it, Blaine?"
10 minutes to 1.
"I won't answer. Let it ring."
Santaine shook her head, staring at the insistent instrument. But he stood up. "Only Doris knows I'm here," he said. "I had to let her know in case..." He didn't have to explain further. Doris was his secretary, the only one in their confidence, and, of course, she had to know where to find him. Santaine picked up the telephone.
"Mrs. Courtney speaking."
She listened for a moment.
"Yes, Doris, he is here."
She handed the telephone to Blaine and turned away. He listened for a few moments, then said quietly, "Thank you, Doris. I'll be there in 20 minutes. He hung up and looked at Santaine. "I'm sorry, Santaine."
"I'll fetch your coat."
She held it for him, and he slipped his arms into the sleeves and turned to face her, buttoning it as he said, "It's Isabella." He saw her surprise and went on, "The doctor is with her. They need me." Doris wouldn't say more, but it sounds serious. After Blaine had gone, she took the coffee pot and cups through to the kitchen and rinsed them in the sink. Seldom had she felt so lonely. The cottage was silent and cold, and she knew she could not sleep. She went back into the lounge and put a gramophone record on the turntable. It was an aria from Verdi's Aida, always one of her favourites. And as she sat and listened to it, the memories it aroused came stealing back out of the past. Michael and Mort Homme and the other long-ago war, and her melancholy swamped her. She slept at last, sitting in the armchair with her legs curled up under her, and the telephone woke her with a start. She reached for it before she was properly awake.
"Blaine."
She recognized his voice instantly.
"What time is it?"
"It's 4 o'clock, a few minutes after."
"Is something wrong, Blaine?"
She came fully awake. "Isabella," he said, "she is asking for you."
"For me?"
Santaine was confused.
"She wants you to come here."
"I can't, Blaine. That's not possible. You know that," Santaine said.
"She's dying, Santaine. The doctor says she won't last out the day."
"Oh, God, Blaine, I'm so sorry."
And with wonder at herself, she realized she truly was.
Poor Isabella.
"Will you come?"
"Do you want me to, Blaine?"
"It is her last request," he said.
"If we refuse it, our guilt will be so much harder to bear."
"I'll come," she said, and hung up.
She took only a few minutes to bathe her face and change and put on light makeup. She drove through the almost deserted streets, and Blaine's big gabled home was the only one in Newlands Avenue with lights burning. He met her at the mahogany double front doors, and he did not embrace her, but said simply, "Thank you, Santaine." Only then she saw his daughter standing in the hall behind him.
"Hello, Tara,"
she greeted her. The girl had been weeping. Her big grey eyes were puffy and swollen and rimmed with red, and her face was so pale that her dark auburn hair seemed to burn like a bush fire. "I'm so sorry to hear about your mother," Santaine said. "No, you aren't." Tara stared at her with a flat, hostile expression, which suddenly wavered and cracked. She sobbed and ran down the passageway. A door slammed in the back of the house. "She's very upset," Blaine said. "I apologize for her." "I understand," Santaine answered. "I deserve at least part of that." He shook his head to deny it, but said simply, "Please come with me." They climbed the circular staircase side by side, and Santaine asked softly, "What is it, Blaine?" "A degeneration of the spine and nervous system, a process that has been going on slowly over the years. Now there is pneumonia, and she can no longer resist." "Pain?" Santaine asked. "Yes," he replied. "She has always had pain, more than the average person could bear." They went down the wide carpeted passageway, and Blaine tapped on the door at the end and then opened it. "Come in, please." The room was large and furnished in cool, restful greens and blues. The curtains were closed, and a night lamp burned on the bedside table. The man standing beside the bed was clearly a doctor. Blaine led Santaine to the four-poster bed, and though she had tried to prepare herself, still she started when she saw the figure that lay upon the banked pillows. She remembered Isabella Malcolmus's serene and gentle beauty. Now, a death's head stared at her from sunken eye sockets, and the fixed grin of yellowish teeth, the rictus of shrunken lips, was somehow obscene. The effect was heightened by the contrast of thick auburn hair, which formed a cloud above the ravaged head.
"It was kind of you to come."
Santaine had to lean closer to the bed to hear the thin voice. "I came as soon as I heard you wanted me," she said. The doctor intervened quietly. "You may stay only a few minutes. Mrs. Malcolmus must rest." But Isabella fluttered her hand impatiently, and Santaine saw that it was a bird's claw of fragile bones, covered with skin the colour of tallow, and a ropey network of blue veins.
"I wish to speak in private," she whispered. "Please leave us, doctor."
Blaine leaned over her to adjust the pillows under her head. "Please don't tire yourself, dear," he said, and his gentleness towards the dying woman gave Santaine a jealous pang she could not suppress. Blaine and the doctor left quietly and closed the door with a click of the latch. They were alone together for the first time. Santaine was overcome by a sense of unreality. For so many years, this woman had bulked large in her life. Her very existence had meant that Santaine had to suffer all the vile emotions from guilt to jealousy, from anger to hatred. But now that she stood beside her deathbed, they had all evaporated. All she felt was a vast sense of pity.
"Come nearer, Santaine," Isabella whispered, beckoning her with another feeble flutter of her wasted hand. "Talking is such an effort."
Impulsively, Santaine went down on her knees beside the bed, so that their eyes were only inches apart. She felt a terrible need to repent for all the unhappiness she had caused, and to ask for Isabella's forgiveness. But Isabella spoke first.
"I told Blaine that I wanted to make my peace with you, Santaine. I told him I understood that the two of you had not been able to help falling in love, and that I realized you had tried to spare me as much as possible. I told him I knew that you were never vindictive, that although you could have taken him away, you never inflicted that final humiliation upon me. That although I was no longer a woman, you allowed me to retain the last shreds of my dignity.
Santaine felt the pity flood her soul and fill her eyes. She wanted to take this frail, dying creature in her arms and hold her. But something in Isabella's eyes prevented her. It was a fierce, proud light, and Santaine simply bowed her head and remained silent.
I told Blaine that you had filled his life with the happiness I could not give him. But despite that, and because of your generosity, I was still able to keep part of him for myself.
Oh, Isabella, I don't know how to tell you.
Santaine's voice choked, and Isabella gestured her to silence. She seemed to be gathering herself for some enormous effort. A faint flash of colour came back into her cheeks, and the fierce light in her eyes flared up. Her breath quickened, and when she spoke again, her voice was stronger, harsher. I told him all these things to persuade him to bring you here. If he had guessed what I truly intended, he would not have allowed you to come. She raised her head from the pillow, and her voice became a serpent's hiss. Now, I can tell you how deeply I have hated you every waking hour of every long year. How my hatred kept me alive this long, so that I could prevent you from having him as your husband. And now that I am dying, that hatred is magnified 100 times. She broke off and panted for breath, as Santaine recoiled before her glare. She realized that Isabella was a woman driven to madness by the agony she had endured, by the long corrosion of hatred and jealousy. If a dying woman's curse has any force, Isabella spoke again, then I curse you, Santaine Courtney, with my last breath. May you experience the same torture you have inflicted upon me. May you know pain as I have known it. The day you stand before the altar with my husband, I will reach out to you from beyond the grave. No!
Santaine stumbled to her teeth and back towards the door.
Stop it, please, stop it!
Isabella laughed, a shrill and taunting sound.
I curse you! And let my curse blight your adulterous passion. I curse every minute the two of you spend together when I have gone. I curse whatever seed he places in your womb. I curse each kiss and touch. I curse you, and I curse your brat. I curse all your issue. An eye for an eye, Santaine Courtney. Heed my words. An eye for an eye.
Santaine ran across the room and flung herself against the door. Throwing it open, she ran down the passage. Blaine was coming up the staircase at a run. He tried to hold her, but she tore herself from his grasp and rushed out through the front doors to where the Daimler was parked. She had been driving for many hours, driving fast with the accelerator pressed to the floorboards, keeping the great 7-litre engine at a long, sustained bellow, sending a tall, pale column of dust into the sky behind her before she consciously realized she was going back into the desert, back to the dreaming, mystical hills that the little bushman called the place of all life.
It was 2 months before Santaine came back out of the Kalahari Desert. For all that time, she had thwarted Blaine's efforts to contact her, refusing to reply to the letters he wrote or the telephone calls he made to both A.B. Abrahams and Dr. Twentyman Jones.
She read the death notices for Isabella Malcomus in the obituary columns of the newspapers which reached the Harney mine only weeks after publication. But they served to increase her feeling of isolation and the brooding premonition of disaster and tragedy which Isabella's death curse had left with her. She returned to Veldhoven in the end only at Chasser's insistence. When she arrived, her hair was floury with dust from the long journey, and she was darkly tanned by the Kalahari sun, but tired and dispirited still. Chasser must have received her telegram and been expecting her. He must have heard the Daimler's motor as she came up the avenue to the chateau. But he was not on the front steps to meet her, and she realized why when she went into her study. He turned from the window from where he had watched her arrival, and now he crossed the room to meet her. He was in uniform. She stopped in the doorway, and an icy stillness froze her. She watched him come towards her, and in her memory, she was carried back down the years and across space to another meeting with a tall and impossibly handsome young man in the same khaki tunic, with the polished belt and Sam Brown cross strap, the peaked cap set at a jaunty angle, and the airman's wings on his chest. "Thank God you've come, Mater," Chasser greeted her. "I had to see you before I left." "When?" She breathed the question, terrified to hear the answer. "When do you go?"
"Tomorrow."
"Where? Where are they sending you?"
"First, we go to Roberts Heights," that was the Air Force training base in the Transvaal, "for conversion to fighters, and after that, wherever they send us. Wish me luck, Mater." She saw that he wore orange flashes on the epaulets of his tunic, the insignia of those who had volunteered to fight beyond the country's borders. "Yes, my darling, I wish you luck," she said, and knew that her heart would break to see him go. The roar of the Rolls-Royce Merlin engine filled his head even through the earphones of the radio telephone that Chasser wore over his leather flying helmet. The cockpit canopy of the Hawker Hurricane fighter aircraft was open, so the slipstream buffeted his head, but it gave him an uninterrupted view of the blue African sky around him. The three fighters flew in a loose arrowhead formation. The dun-coloured desert camouflage could not disguise their beautiful, deadly lines. Chasser led the flight. His promotion had been rapid. Command came naturally to him. He had learned that lesson well from Santayne Courtney. It had taken only 18 months for him to reach the rank of squadron leader. He flew in a short-sleeved khaki tunic, khaki shorts, and with velkskoen on his bare feet, for the summer heat of Abyssinia was brutal. Around his waist was belted a Webley service revolver, an archaic weapon for a pilot of a modern pursuit aircraft. But all of them had taken to wearing sidearms since the intelligence section had circulated those obscene photographs. One of the motorized recce units had overrun a village in the mountains and found the remains of two South African pilots who had been forced down and captured by the Abyssinian irregulars, the Shufta, Wild Hill Bandits. The pilots had been given to the women of the village. They had first been emasculated, then flayed with hot irons and disemboweled so skillfully that they were still living as their viscera was drawn from them. Finally, their jaws had been wedged open with thorn branches, and the women had urinated into their open mouths until they drowned. So, all the pilots carried sidearms now, to defend themselves first, and then to make certain they were never captured alive. Today, the air was clear and bright under a cloudless azure sky,
and visibility was unlimited. Below and ahead stretched the rugged Abyssinian highlands, precipitous ambers, the huge table-topped mountains, the dark, deep gorges between, desert and rock, dry and sun-bleached to the dun colour of an old lion's scarred hide. The three fighters bored upwards, striving for height. They had scrambled from the dusty forward airstrip at Yerga Alem only minutes before, in response to a faint but desperate appeal over the field radio from the advancing infantry. And Shasha wheeled the flight onto the northern heading and picked out the thin, pale thread of the road winding through the mountains far below them. Immediately he resumed the Philet-Piter's scan, his head pivoting and turning, eyes darting and flicking, never allowed to fix and focus short, up and around and down, in a regular, never-ceasing motion. And he saw them first. They were tiny specks, a cloud of black midges against the aching blue. "Popeye Flight, this is Leader. Tally-ho," he said into the microphone of his radio telephone. 11 o'clock high. 10 plus, and they look like Capronis. Buster! Buster!" Buster was the order to go to full throttle. "I have them," Dave Abrahams answered immediately. It was extraordinary that they had been able to keep together, from the training days at Roberts Heights, through all the vagaries of the East African campaign, until now they were fighting with Dan Pienaar's South African Corps, driving the Duke of Aosta's Italians back through the mountains towards Addis Ababa. Shasha glanced across at him. David had also brought his Hurricane up on Shasha's starboard wingtip. He also had his canopy open, and they flashed a grin across at each other. David's large, beaky nose had been burned raw and pink by the sun, and the straps of his helmet hung unbuckled under his chin. It was a good feeling to have him on his wing. Then both of them closed their canopies in preparation for the attack and looked ahead. Shasha brought the flight around into a gentle turn, climbing up into the sun, the classic fighter tactics. The distant midges resolved swiftly into the familiar silhouettes of three-engined Caproni bombers. Shasha counted 12, four sticks of three. They were going for the crossroads at Karin again, where the South African advance was bottled into the pass between the soaring walls of the high ambers, and at that moment Shasha saw the bombs drop away from below the leading bombers. Still under full throttle, the Rolls-Royce engines screamed in protest as they climbed out, turning into the sun that blinded the Italian gunners. Shasha winged over and went down into the attack. He could see the bomb bursts now, tiny fountains of pale dust spurting up around the crossroads, falling amongst the ant-like column of vehicles in the gut of the hills. Those poor bastards down there were taking a pounding, and as they tore down the sky, the second flight of Capronis released their bomb loads. The fat grey eggs, finned at one end, went down with a deceptively slow wobbling motion. And Shasha twisted his head around in one last sweep of the heavens, squinting into the sun, checking that the Italian fighters were not waiting up there, lying in ambush. But the sky was unsullied blue, and he switched his full attention back to his gun sight. He picked out the leading Caproni in the third flight, hoping his attack would spoil the bomblayer's aim. And he touched left rudder and rotated the Hurricane's nose downwards a hair's breadth, until the silver and blue Caproni swam gently into the rose of his gun sight. 600 yards, and he held his fire. He could see the insignia of the fasces on the fuselage, the bundled rods and axe of Imperial Rome. The heads of the two pilots in the cockpit were inclined earthwards, watching for the fall of the bombs. The twin machine guns in the revolving power turret were trained aft. 500 yards, back. He could see the head and shoulders of the turret gunner. The back of his helmet was towards Shasha. He had not yet spotted the three deadly machines screaming down onto his starboard quarter. 400 yards. So close that Chasser could see the scorching of fumes around the exhaust ports of the Caproni's engines, and the gunner still was unaware. 300 yards. The bomb bay of the Caproni began to open under her swollen belly, pregnant with death. Now Chasser could make out the rows of rivet heads along the silver fuselage and on the wide blue wings. He settled his grip on the joystick between his knees and slipped the safety lock on the firing button, readying the 8 Browning machine guns in his wings. 200 yards. He played the rudder bars with his toes, and the gun sight drifted over the Caproni's fuselage. He stared through it, frowning slightly with concentration, his lower lip caught between his front teeth. Suddenly, a line of bright, fiery, phosphorescent beads strung across the nose of his Hurricane. The gunner of the second Caproni had spotted him at last and fired a warning burst across his nose. 100 yards. The gunner and both pilots in the leading Caproni, alerted by the bursts of fire, had looked round and seen him. The turret gunner was traversing frantically, trying to bring his guns to bear. Through the gun sight, Chasser could see his white face, contorted with terror. 80 yards. Still frowning, Chasser pressed down with his thumb on the firing button. The Hurricane shuddered and slowed to the recoil of 8 Brownings, and Chasser was thrown gently forward against his shoulder straps by the deceleration. Bright streams of tracer, sparkling like electricity, hosed into the Caproni, and Chasser watched the strike of shot, directing it with quick, subtle touches of his controls. The Italian gunner never fired his turret guns. The Perspex canopy disintegrated around him, and concentrated fire tore him to shreds. Half his head and one of his arms were pulled off, like those of a careless child's rag doll, and went spinning and bouncing away in the propeller's wash. Instantly, Chasser switched his aim, picking up the silver coin of the spinning propeller and the vulnerable wing root of the Caproni in his sights. The crisp silhouette of the wing dissolved like wax in a candle flame. Glycerin and fuel vapour poured from the motor in liquid sheets, and the whole wing pivoted slowly backwards on its route, and then tore away and spun off, a dead leaf in the slipstream. The bomber flipped over on its back and went down in a flat inverted spiral, unbalanced by the missing wing, weaving irregular zigzag patterns of smoke and vapour and flame down the sky. And Chasser turned all his attention to the next formation of bombers. He brought the Hurricane round still under full throttle, and he pulled his turn so tightly that the blood drained away from his brain and his vision turned grey and shadowy. He tensed his belly muscles and clenched his jaw to resist the drainage of blood and levelled out on a head-on course with the next Caproni in line. The two aircraft raced together with terrifying speed. The nose of the Caproni swelled miraculously to fill all Chasser's vision, and he fired into it at point-blank range and then pulled up his nose, and they flashed past each other so close that he felt the bump and jar of the bomber's slipstream. He came round again, hard and furiously, breaking up the Italian formations, scattering them across the sky, turning and diving and firing, until, with that abruptness that is so much part of aerial combat, they were all gone. He was alone, in an enormously blue and empty sky, and he was sweating with adrenaline reaction. His grip on the control column was so tight that it hurt his knuckles. He throttled back and checked his fuel gauge. Those desperate minutes at full throttle had burned over half a tankful. "Popeye flight, this is Leader. Come in, all units." He spoke into his microphone and the response was immediate. "Leader, this is 3. That was the third hurricane, with young LaRue at the controls.
I'm down to a quarter of a tank.
All right, three, return independently to base, Shasser ordered. And then he called again.
Popeye 2, this is Leader. Do you read me?
Shasser was searching the sky around him, trying to pick up David's aircraft, feeling the first prickle of anxiety.
Come in, Popeye 2,
he repeated, and looked down, searching for smoke rising from a wrecked aircraft in the broken brown land below. Then his pulse jumped as David's voice came in clearly through his headphones.
Leader, this is 2. I have damage.
David, where the hell are you?
Approximately 10 miles east of Karine Crossroads, at 8,000 feet.
Shasser glanced into the easterly quarter and almost instantly picked out a thin grey line being swiftly drawn above the blue horizon towards the south. It looked like a feather.
David, I see smoke in your area. Are you on fire?
Affirmative. I have an engine fire.
I'm coming, David. Hold on.
Shasser flung the Hurricane's wing up in a steep turn and rammed the throttle open to its stop. David was a little below him, and he went screaming down the sky.
David, how bad is it?
Roast turkey, David said laconically, and ahead of him, Shasser made out the burning Hurricane. David had his stricken machine in a steep sideslip, so that the flames were not streaming back over the cockpit canopy, but were being blown out to one side. He was going down fast, trying to build up speed to the critical point when the fire would be starved of oxygen and would extinguish itself spontaneously. Shasser bore down on him and then eased back his own speed and kept slightly above and 200 yards off. He could see the bullet holes in the other machine's engine cowling and wing. One of the Italian gunners had got in a good burst at David. The paintwork was blackening and blistering back down the Hurricane's fuselage, almost as far as the cockpit, and David was struggling with the Perspex canopy, trying to open it.
A jammed canopy, and David will cook, Shasser thought, but at that moment the canopy came free and slid back easily, and David looked across at him.
The air around his head was distorted by the shimmering heat of invisible flames, and a brown patch appeared on the sleeve of David's tunic as the khaki cotton scorched.
No good. I'm hitting the silk, Shasser.
He saw David's lips move, and his voice echoed in Shasser's earphones, but before he could reply, David pulled the helmet from his head and released his shoulder straps. He lifted one hand in a farewell salute, and then turned the burning Hurricane onto its back and fell out of the open cockpit. He went down with arms and legs spread in an untidy sprawling starfish, beginning to turn like a cartwheel, until suddenly a cascade of silk burst from his parachute pack, bloomed into a glistening snowy flower over him, and he was jerked backwards, his fall broken. And he drifted away towards the parched, dung-coloured earth 5,000 feet below, the light breeze carrying his parachute away towards the south. Shasser throttled his Hurricane back until he was losing height at the same rate as the descending parachute, and he circled David slowly, keeping 200 or 300 yards separation from his dangling body, craning his head over the side of his open cockpit, trying to estimate where David would land, and then glancing anxiously at the fuel gauge on his instrument panel. The needle hovered just above the red line. David's burning Hurricane smashed into the dusty plain below the soaring embers and exploded in a quick dragon's breath of smoke, and Shasser surveyed the ground. Directly below were ridges of iron grey, which peaked into cones of darker rock. Between the ridges were stony hollows, rough as a crocodile's skin, and then, just beyond the last ridge, a softer, smoother valley. As they descended, he made out the regular furrows of primitive cultivation on the gentle slopes of the valley.
David would come down on, or very close to, the final ridge. Shasta's eyes narrowed. Human habitation. There was a tiny group of thatched huts at the end of the valley, and for a moment his spirits rose. Then he remembered the photographs. Those mutilated and desecrated lumps of human flesh. And his jaw clenched as he looked across at David, swaying and swinging on the parachute shrouds. He banked the hurricane away, turning and dropping down towards the valley, and he levelled out at 50 feet above the ground and flew back between the rock ridges up the shallow valley. He roared over the rude fields of cultivation, scraggy stalks of sorghum standing in ragged lines, stunted and browned by drought, and then ahead of him he saw human figures. A group of men were running down the valley from the village. 20 or more figures in long, dirty grey robes that flapped around their bare back legs as they ran. Their hair was teased up into fuzzy, dark bushes, and all of them were armed. Some with modern carbines, probably looted from the battlefield, others with the long, muzzle-loading jezails. As the hurricane roared low over their heads, three or four of them stopped running and threw their rifles to their shoulders, pointing them up at Shasta. He saw the flash of black powder smoke as they fired, but did not feel the bullets hit his aircraft. Shasta needed no further evidence of their hostile intentions. The armed men were streaming along the bottom of the ridge, waving their rifles, racing to intercept the tiny figure on the floating parachute. Shasta dropped down again, lined up the running group, and at 500 yards opened up with the 8 Brownings. Sheets of tracer and dust flew up around the group of robed figures in a raging storm, and he saw 4 or 5 of them picked up and flung down again by the hail of machine gun fire. Then he was forced to climb out to miss the hills at the head of the valley, and as he came around once more, he saw that the Shufta had regrouped and were once again running to intercept David, who was at less than 1,000 feet now. It was clear that he would fall on the slope of the ridge.